I'm John Strum, and this is Real Talk MS. It's December 17th, and we have a lot to talk about. And I'd like to start things off by saying thank you. Because last week, Apple announced that there were just over 800,000 podcasts available in Apple Podcasts. And last week in Apple Podcasts, you guys made Real Talk MS the number 16 podcast in the medicine category in the United States. You made our podcast number 10 in the medicine category in Denmark. Real Talk MS is ranked number 137 in the UK and number 85 in Australia. And I've been told by people who know a lot more about podcasting than I do that this is truly special for a podcast that's aimed at such a specific niche audience. And those incredible rankings only reflect the podcast listeners that use an Apple device to listen. So all I can say is thank you for your attention, your loyalty, your feedback. I never take the Real Talk MS listener community for granted, and I try hard to earn your loyalty and attention each and every week. My guest this week is Professor Gavin Giovannoni, and if you keep up with MS news through social media, then you already know that name. Professor Giovannoni is not only a leading academic neurologist in the United Kingdom, but he's also a prolific blogger, tweeter, speaker, author, and opinion leader. And not too long ago, Professor Giovannoni said that MS is preventable. So that's the first thing we'll talk about in our conversation. But before we get to my conversation with Professor Giovannoni, there are a few other things that you should know about. As 2019 is drawing to a close, it seems like the appropriate time to take a look back at some of the news that was most important to people affected by MS. And looking at MS disease-modifying therapy seems like a very good place to start. So in 2019, we saw the FDA grant approval to three new MS drugs: Vumerity, Mayzent, and Mavenclad. All three drugs treat relapsing forms of MS, and the FDA indicated that Mayzent and Mavenclad were also approved for treating active secondary progressive MS. This particular qualification sent people living with secondary progressive MS to their neurologists to try to understand whether or not their secondary progressive MS was active. Well, this has touched off quite a debate within the neurology community. And I wouldn't be surprised at all if we saw the term active secondary progressive MS being further debated, reconsidered, and somehow clarified in the coming year. In addition to the three new MS drugs that received FDA approval, positive research results for two investigational drugs were reported at the European Committee for Treatment and Research in Multiple Sclerosis, or ECTRIMS, the largest MS research conference in the world. A drug called ofatumumab outperformed Aubagio in reducing MS relapse rates during clinical trials, and an oral medication called ponesimod also outperformed Aubagio in reducing relapse rates during clinical trials. Stem cell therapy was certainly in the news in 2019. A study from Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine showed that autologous hematopoietic stem cell transplantation, or HSCT, was more effective than disease-modifying therapy for treating highly active relapsing-remitting MS. Over a two-year period following receiving HSCT, only 3 out of 55 patients had disease progression, compared to 34 out of 55 patients who received disease-modifying therapy during that same time period. And while HSCT continues to show promise, stem cell tourism was also a hot topic in 2019. Now, stem cell tourism used to refer to people who left the United States to travel to Mexico, Costa Rica, Panama and elsewhere, to so-called stem cell clinics that offered unapproved and frequently risky stem cell treatments. But people living in the United States with MS and other chronic illnesses no longer have to travel very far at all to be conned out of thousands of dollars for unproven, unapproved, risky stem cell treatments, because there are more than 700 shady stem cell clinics in California, Florida, and elsewhere that promise stem cell treatments that will cure everything from arthritis to erectile dysfunction to Parkinson's disease to multiple sclerosis. And as I've said before, the only outcome you can be sure about with these treatments is that patients find themselves losing thousands of dollars that they've spent on a so-called treatment that never seems to deliver the promised results. And those are the lucky patients. The unlucky patients are the ones that come away from these procedures developing tumors, serious infections, or they simply die. Legitimate stem cell therapy research will continue to be in the news in 2020 as researchers work to understand how to best administer stem cell treatment safely and which patients will most likely benefit from those treatments. And illegitimate stem cell clinics will also continue to be in the news in 2020 as the FDA has finally started to crack down on shady stem cell clinic operators, while new con artists are getting into the phony stem cell treatment business to try to grab their share of a multi-billion dollar market. And you can be sure that throughout 2020, we'll continue talking about the important and promising work being done in real stem cell research, as well as the fraud being perpetrated by con men preying on desperate people searching for some relief. MS biomarkers were in the news in 2019, and just as a reminder, a biomarker is a measurable biological entity found in blood or other body fluids or tissue, whose presence is indicative of some phenomenon such as disease, infection, or environmental exposure. For instance, if you're not feeling well and you visit your doctor may take a blood sample, and one of the things that will be checked in that blood sample is your white cell count, because a high white blood cell count is a biomarker for infection. In the case of multiple sclerosis, researchers are looking for a biomarker that might predict MS progression or even determine whether someone is likely to be diagnosed with MS in the future. And in 2019, research scientists presented multiple studies demonstrating that levels of neurofilament light chain were increased in the blood and cerebrospinal fluid of MS patients. Now, neurofilament light chain is usually only found in nerve cells, but as MS causes the progressive degeneration of nerve cells, neurofilament light chain is released into the blood and cerebrospinal fluid. Other studies showed increased levels of neurofilament light chain 6 years before the clinical onset of MS. And research presented at ACTRIMS, that's the America's Committee for Treatment and Research in MS, showed that early levels of neurofilament light chain could identify which patients were at greater risk for developing a more severe disease course. Biomarkers are important because they can serve as endpoints in clinical trials. They have the potential to shorten clinical trials, and that means that new therapies can make their way to market sooner. And that's good news in any year. And speaking of new therapies, the constantly rising cost of MS prescription medication was in the news in 2019. Just last week, the U.S. House of Representatives passed the Elijah E. Cummings Lower Drug Costs Now Act of 2019. And it's significant because this bill is a shot across the bow at the ever-escalating price of prescription medications in the United States. Specifically, the bill empowers Medicare to negotiate with drug manufacturers on the prices of up to 250 different medications. Now, Medicare covers 60 million Americans, so the price that Medicare pays for drugs has huge market implications. And you may remember that just a couple of weeks ago, we revisited the study that showed that between the years 2006 and 2016, the cost of MS medication for Medicare patients increased sevenfold, raising the total Medicare price tag for MS medications from $19 million in 2006 to almost $150 million in 2016. So allowing Medicare to negotiate on these prices is a very significant step. The Lower Drug Costs Now Act also requires that drug manufacturers justify any price increases that exceed 10% annually or 25% over 3 years. And the bill establishes a cap on out-of-pocket expense for drugs purchased under Medicare Part D. And while this is very good news, I see it mostly as symbolic news, sort of putting the pharmaceutical industry on notice that the U.S. Congress is finally getting serious about the runaway cost of prescription drugs in America. I'm not so sure we'll see this particular bill getting through the U.S. Senate in its current form. And even if it wins congressional approval, there's no guarantee that the president will sign it into law. But it's still a very meaningful step in the right direction. And no journey, no matter how long or how difficult, can even get started until you take that very first step forward. Make no mistake, healthcare is going to be at or near the top of the political agenda as we get closer to the 2020 election. And you can be sure that we'll be talking about it as the issue is debated in Congress, in the courts, and by all of the U.S. presidential candidates. Certainly, one of the most important news events of 2019 was the release of the new MS prevalence study. You know, going all the way back to the 1970s, any time that MS was written about, talked about, or in some way highlighted in the media, the story was that there were about 400,000 people in the United States who were living with multiple sclerosis. And we all knew that that number seemed low. I mean, it seems like everyone knows someone who's living with MS. But the last time that anyone tried to determine how many people were living with MS in the United States was back in 1975. Well, a lot's changed in the world since 1975, but not that number. That is, until this year, when the results of a new MS prevalence study were released. And it turns out that there are almost 1 million people across the United States who are living with MS, more than twice as many as had been reported for the last few decades. It's a number that demands attention. It's a number that tells our members of Congress that more resources need to be devoted to solving MS. It tells the research community that more work needs to be done. And it tells organizations like the National MS Society, which funded the prevalence study, that more than twice as many people are in need of the kinds of services and support that the society is so good at delivering. When I think about that new number, when I consider that there are nearly 1 million people in the United States who are living with MS, I think about the 1 million families affected by MS. I think about the family members, I think about the caregivers. So the real number of people who are affected by MS here in the U.S. actually grows to several million. This is no small thing. And what I'm most proud of is that we talked about every one of these important issues over the course of the year, in real time, as the research studies were being published and the announcements were being made. Oh, and speaking of announcements that were made this past year, I guess I'd be overlooking the obvious if I didn't mention that 2019 ended with some pretty big news about Real Talk MS. And of course, that was last month's announcement of my partnership with the National MS Society. And that partnership is already extending the reach of the podcast. It means that the Real Talk MS listener community is going to continue to grow in the coming year. I'm excited. And I'm looking forward to sharing the news, views, interviews, and breakthroughs that impact people affected by MS as they continue to occur in 2020. As technology continues to advance, the rate of scientific discovery continues to accelerate. And that in itself is good news. It means that we're going to have a lot to talk about in the new year. And in just a moment, we'll be talking with my guest, Professor Gavin Giovannone. Professor Gavin Giovannone is an academic neurologist based at Barts and the London School of Medicine and Dentistry, Queen Mary University, London. Professor Giovannone's current research is focused on Epstein-Barr virus as a possible cause of multiple sclerosis, MS-related neurodegeneration, biomarker discovery and validation, and MS clinical outcomes. Welcome to the podcast, Professor Giovannone.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Well, I've heard you say that MS is preventable. Now, that's not something that people living with MS are used to hearing. So I guess I have a two-part question. Is MS preventable? And if it is, how do we prevent it?
Yes. So the epidemiologists, these are the people that study MS at a population level, have identified important environmental risk factors that increase your risk of getting MS. And so a large number of these environmental risk factors that have been associated with an increased risk of getting MS are preventable. Just to go through it, the one that everybody knows about is low vitamin D, or living in places where you have low vitamin D. Whether it's actually the vitamin D itself or the lack of sunlight exposure hasn't really been explained yet. But the principle would be if you supplement people when they're very young with vitamin D, for example, you may reduce the incidence of multiple sclerosis. And this is based on migration studies, for example. If you move from an area of high risk to an area of low risk as an adult, you take a risk with you. So something happens in childhood or early adolescence. If you go as a child, your risk drops. And if you're born in those low-risk countries, your risk is very low. So the environment, in my opinion, trumps the genetics that go with this disease. And so that environmental factor that you're exposed to, we think, is sunlight, vitamin D. So there has been a big group of people been wanting to do vitamin D supplementation trials for decades. The problem with those trials, though, is the logistics and how you do them. And the community has never been able to agree to the right dose, the trial design, and all that, which is a great tragedy because I think we've let down the next generation of people who are going to get the disease. So that's vitamin D supplementation. The next one is smoking. We know that smoking increases the risk by about 50%. And the problem is how do you get people not to smoke? Public health doctors have been quite effective at reducing smoking rates, but there's still a problem with teenage, particularly amongst teenage girls in the UK, and that to get them not to smoke. The other thing that's an important risk factor that's just emerged over the last few decades is childhood and adolescent obesity. And we know that's partly driven by change in lifestyle, so we become more sedentary. But the other big issue is the problem with sugar consumption. We know now that sugar is probably the main driver, or carbohydrates is the main driver of obesity. And governments are beginning to start addressing this by putting in policies like sugar tax, etc. But I think they need to be much more proactive. So we've actually done a little study and we've modeled it, and we think about 15% of MS cases are caused by childhood adolescent obesity. So by just preventing childhood adolescent obesity, we should be able to reduce the number of MS cases by 15%. Stopping people smoking, we may be able to reduce the number of people getting MS by about 20%. So those two factors put together may reduce MS incidence by a third. Vitamin D could even be higher than that if it is preventable by vitamin D. So, you know, these things are not trivial when you start talking about a population. But the biggest environmental risk factor is the virus, Epstein-Barr virus. And the epidemiology is pretty overwhelming that it's causally linked to MS. Somewhere in the pathway, Epstein-Barr virus acts. And the reason why I say that is that if you don't get the virus, the chance of getting MS is virtually zero based on epidemiology studies. So those people that remain Epstein-Barr virus negative don't get MS. And that's the core bit of the epidemiology that supports a vaccine study. can we vaccinate people at a certain age, prevent them getting the wild type or getting infected with Epstein-Barr virus, and then see what happens to whether or not they get MS. That's one of the programs we're working on, is to try and get a vaccine strategy developed. So when the Epstein-Barr virus vaccine is developed, we can actually test it to prevent MS.
You know, I've also heard you say that progressive MS is modifiable. And I think that's such an important statement, because I know of situations where someone living with progressive MS loses interest in rehabilitation and medication because their mindset is that none of these things are really going to help me. What would you say to someone living with progressive or more advanced MS who might hold that perception?
Yeah, I think it's us, the MS community, that's done that. We've talked about this thing called the therapeutic window, or the window of opportunity, where you have to treat this disease quite early to make a difference. That is quite true, in the sense that you've got more to gain by treating the disease earlier, because the whole purpose of MS treatments is to prevent the accumulation of damage and the disability. And what we did was we designed our clinical trials based on early MS, and we never really went into progressive MS or advanced MS. So we're talking about people that are, you know, using walking aids or wheelchairs. And the reason for that is our outcome measure is so dominated by our walking that we decided to stop our trials at an EDSS of 6 or 6.5, and we never took people with more advanced disease in. And what we have realized now is that even in people with more advanced disease, they still got upper limb, for example, upper limb cognition, they still got swallowing and speech. These are important functions that need to be preserved. And hidden in the literature, old trials and actually our new trials have shown that even if you've lost lower limb function or almost lost lower limb function, there's still a big treatment effect in the upper limbs. So you can actually slow down the worsening of upper limb function or hands and arms. And that's why we had this campaign now for about 5 years. It's called Think Hand, as to how we get the MS communities not just focus on legs, but focus on hand function. And we've managed to get funding in place to do two trials. One of them is ocrelizumab in primary progressive MS. And we're going up to EDSS 8, so this is into wheelchair users. And the primary outcome is not going to be walking function, lower limb function. It's going to be looking at upper limb function. How do we preserve hand function? And the primary outcome is a thing called the nine-hole PEC test, which people with multiple sclerosis may know about. It's just assessing how the hand functions in doing these nine-hole PEC tests. And independently of that, our own institution, we're doing another one called Chariot MS, where we're going to be taking people that are needing walking aids. So this is EDSS 6, so needing a walking stick, right up to 8.5 wheelchair users. And again, the primary outcome is going to be upper limb function, the nine-hole PEC test. And the drug we're going to be using is oral cladribine or Mavenclad, which is now a drug that's licensed throughout the world. So both these trials are actually challenging this paradigm that once you've got advanced disease, it's not modifiable. We're actually going to say to people, actually, we can. We can actually slow down worsening of disability in the upper limbs. And that's important for people with a disease, because when you're in a wheelchair, your arms and your hands or your legs, you try and tell somebody with MS, you know, nothing to be done. You know, natural history is going to run its course, and you're busy losing upper limb function. So, you know, keeping upper limb function there keeps them independent, keeps them engaged, keeps them involved. So, this is why we're trying to promote our Think Hand campaign. We're also in the process of designing a third trial, and this is called the Salvage trial. This doesn't apply to countries outside of the UK, I hope, but in the United Kingdom, when you need a wheelchair, we have to stop your existing disease-modifying treatment. Or when you become secondary progressive or progressive, we have to stop your existing disease-modifying treatment. And we think that's wrong. And so what we want to do is what we call a randomized withdrawal study. When people get to that stage, they have to stop their disease-modifying treatment. We actually randomize them to a placebo and an active treatment. The treatment we want to use is probably rituximab. It's an anti-CD20 therapy that has been used in MS before. And we compare those two groups to show our payer, the NHS, actually, it's not right to stop people's therapy when they hit a wheelchair. they're still benefiting from their treatment, and they should continue their treatment or at least get switched to this treatment, rituximab, that we're going to test. So we're very, very proactive in trying to move the MS community away from just thinking about lower limb ambulation and thinking about how important hand function is for people with the disease. Does that answer your question?
It answers my question, and I could not agree with you more. As my wife lives with rather advanced progressive MS, and I have seen how mobility can be offset. There are lots of ways that people can still be mobile, even if their legs are problematic. But when you begin to lose that upper limb function, you feel less useful. That, to me, is where disability becomes a lot more profound in terms of quality of life.
Talking about quality of life, so we, as part of this Think Hand campaign, we would go to lots of MS centers, MS meetings, where people with the disease would come. And so we did this little survey. We should probably publish it. It's more qualitative research rather than, you know, proper research. We just asked people, you know, what function do they value in terms of their quality of life? And, you know, time and time again, what came out, particularly amongst women, as you know, MS is more common in women, were grooming things, you know, being able to put your contact lens in, being able to comb your hair or brush your hair, put makeup on, put earrings on, put lipstick on, make, you know, these things just kept coming up over and over again. The ability for people to groom, to look beautiful, and to be able to go out into society and interact with society. And the fact that the people were going to be losing these functions because their hand function was getting worse, is we forget that there's this other side of MS, which is about how do you provide people with the ability to remain connected with society. You know, MS is incredibly socially isolating, and you know, being able to function or at least be mobile and get out, you require hand function. As soon as you lose upper limb function, you are essentially dependent on somebody else for your care and everything, and you become completely you lose your independence completely, which is what we're trying to avoid by this program of research.
I know that you also serve as the chair of the MS Brain Health Steering Committee, and MS Brain Health, among other things, calls for improving MS care globally. Could you talk about some of the disparities in MS care that exist between countries?
Yeah, so what came out of, I mean, what prompted the MS Brain Health campaign was actually I started a blog called the Bart's MS blog. And, you know, what became quite apparent is that MS is managed, based on the comments and the feedback we got, MS is managed very differently across the world. You know, in some environments, it's the community. The MS teams are very proactive. They try and diagnose and treat as quickly as possible, and they treat the disease using evidence. Other parts of the world, MS is just very passively managed. You know, patients get delayed in diagnosis. There's restrictions on how they can be treated, and so there's an enormous variation. Actually, even within countries, even in the UK where I work, depending where you go, your service differs. There's lots of variation. And we thought this was wrong. You know, in other disease areas, like particularly cancer, for example, there are lots of initiatives to standardize how patients are managed and the care they get. And so we thought we needed something, we needed a policy document, essentially. You know, what can we produce that would have some influence on healthcare payers and healthcare systems and politicians to change the way MS is. So that's what we did with the Brain Health document, is to try and activate the MS community to manage MS more proactively and try and get rid of variation across the world. It's actually common sense. It's, you know, the things we've said, you've got to get people into the systems as quickly as possible. So get referred from family doctors for diagnosis much quicker, get diagnosed much quicker, get onto treatment much quicker. If you're not responding to that treatment, get your treatment escalated or changed much quicker. Involve people with the disease in the decision-making around their care. Also focus on other things that affect MS outcomes. So this is where the brain health title comes from. You know, how can you get them to stop smoking, exercise, improve their diets, sleep better, try and get them off medications that may make their disease worse. be proactive about preventing infections, particularly like recurrent bladder infections, which can make MS worse. So it's also focusing on what we call the holistic management of MS. And then also as part of this is collect data. It's, you know, what drives change usually is data. So you can show that if people are managed in one way, they're going to do better, and then use that data to improve the services elsewhere. So this is the Brain Health Initiative. And so our aim was not to just focus on the here and now, but to think about that person when they're older, because what happens is, unfortunately, as you get older, everybody develops age-related neurodegeneration. And, you know, part of the aging process is losing balance centers, losing your cognition. And what protects people from that is the size of your brain, the so-called brain reserve. And so what we wanted the MS community to focus on is it's not just about treating MS now. It's about how do we treat it now so that people can get to old age with a healthy brain and age normally. And so it's like trying to shift the focus into the future for the MS community. I must say the Brain Health Time Matters initiative has been very successful. We've had well over 50 organizations across the globe endorse the document. So you know, this is saying this is actually what we how we should be managing MS. And what we're doing now is we're trying to not just have information, but we're trying to attach to that a thing called the Quality Improvement Program, where you actually analyze the service you're giving to see how you're performing relative to these standards that we've attached to the brain health policy statements. And that means you as a neurologist or a MS center can actually audit yourself and see how good your service is relative to international standards. And if it's not good enough, that may mean you need more resource. So you could then use the policy document to actually and use the data you've collected about your service to go to your funders and say, look, we're not practicing up to standard yet. We need, you know, more neurologists, more MRI scanners, whatever it is, that's the bottleneck. So it's kind of like a way of creating an international quality improvement service for MS practitioners. And the next phase of this is also now to complete the loop, and it's to give people with the disease the ability to rate their service. But it's not just a satisfaction, smiley face type thing we're trying to do. We're not trying to create a satisfaction survey. What we're trying to get is people with the disease to actually ask questions about their MS service. Was I involved in the decision making? Am I getting my annual MRI scan? Are they monitoring my disability? Are they monitoring my bloods and the side effects of the medication? So it's actually drilling down and saying, am I getting the right service based on the international standards? And if they're not, then the person with the disease can give their MS center a bad review, like TripAdvisor, bad review, and that'll go to that center, and the center will say, actually, this person is right, you know, we should improve things. So it's kind of like creating a virtuous cycle where we get quality improvement. That's what we're trying to do, and hopefully these initiatives will, I like to use the term raise the bar across the world, and people with MS will get a better care.
Well, while we're talking about differences in MS care, I know one of the things that you've advocated for is the adoption of what you've called the Grassroots Affordable DMT Initiative. Can you tell me what that initiative is about?
Yeah, so this is really not about the rich world. It's not about high-income countries where actually, it could be about high-income countries because, you know, even in the United States, there's a large number of people that are disenfranchised. They don't have access to insurance and they're uninsured and they have problems getting onto treatments because they're so expensive. Also, in middle and low-income countries, they just can't afford you know, these high-cost innovative DMTs, the disease-modifying treatments are just too expensive. You know, and if they do pay for these treatments, they often go bankrupt. It bankrupts the family because the treatments are so high. And so there is a large number of therapies that have been shown to work in MS that are cheap. They tend to be off-patent, so they haven't been licensed for a disease. And, you know, what we're trying to do is we're trying to create a system where we can actually say to neurologists practicing in, say, Africa or India or Asia, actually, there is something you can do for that patient who can't afford the expensive drugs. You can actually prescribe these affordable drugs. And so one of the things we find is that clinicians are often scared, nervous to prescribe off-label these treatments. And so what we'd like to do is create a international movement where we support each other. We give them protocols on how to use these therapies, what tests to do before they start them, how to monitor them when their people are on them, and the trying to say to them it's better to be on one of these treatments than to be on nothing. And so the affordable disease modifying treatment list is basically an initiative is basically to create this list, summarize the evidence why these drugs work, and put in place the necessary what we would call protocols that clinicians use and to use them safely in their environments. And that list is going to be variable because in some countries, some of these therapies, there's one of the therapy that's used most commonly, it's called rituximab. It's a biological therapy. It's given as an infusion, it's an antibody treatment. Even though that's off patent now and there are so-called biosimilars, these are generic equivalents, they're still quite expensive. So that'll be on our affordable list. But in some countries, it's going to be unaffordable. That so, it's going to be what I would call a relative affordable DMT list, depending on where you live. So I suspect in some middle-income countries, rituximab may be affordable. But in say some African countries or some Asian countries, it's going to be unaffordable, and then they'll have to go to some of the small molecules. So this is just getting off the. I mean, I've been wanting to do this for 4 or 5 years actually, and I thought this process would happen. There was another initiative that the International MS Federation had put in place. We're going via the WHO, World Health Organization, essential medicine list, and we thought by getting drugs onto the essential medicine list, we may be able to pressurize countries to supply these therapies. But unfortunately, our application to get drugs onto the essential medicine list failed. And the whole process of doing that is slow. And, you know, the affordable disease modifying treatment initiative is a way to try and speed up the adoption of this concept and the treatment of people with this disease in what I call resource poor environments.
Well, I'll remind our listeners that if they want to find out more about MS brain health, or follow your blog, I'm going to include links to both in today's show notes. Professor Giovannoni, thank you for your contributions to what we know about MS today, for making a point of reminding people living with MS of the importance and the benefit of effective early treatment, and for your advocacy on behalf of the social and political issues that impact quality of care for people living with MS. And thanks for talking with me today.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me.
This week's episode of Real Talk MS is powered by the National MS Society. If you know someone who might enjoy listening to the podcast, you can share this episode with them by suggesting they point their web browser to realtalkms.com/120. That's realtalkms.com/120. And you'll find that link in today's show notes so you can easily copy and paste it right into your email or text. Please don't forget to visit the Apple App Store or the Google Play Store and download the free Real Talk MS app to your iOS or Android smartphone or tablet. It's the easiest way to connect to the podcast. The app will automatically download the latest episode of Real Talk MS. You'll be able to save your favorite episodes, and it's a great way for me to share all sorts of bonus content with you in the weeks and months ahead. And in the coming year, I'm going to be focusing on creating bonus content that'll only be available on the Real Talk MS app. In fact, I'll give you a little preview of that next week. So I hope you'll take a moment and check out the Real Talk MS app. I'm John Strum. Thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next time.